always to kind of limit the blue aspect, or you can put it on a timer so that if you have it set for some sunset period, it will give it a kind of incandescent reddish cast and have much lower blue content. So there's different ways. You can either do it directly with glasses that have blue blockers, or you can do it via software or operating systems these days. So there's a lot of different ways. Matter of fact, I have a story about something that actually happened to me years ago. My nephew had a laptop computer, and he complained bitterly that his eyes were killing him. And I went there and took a look and saw what was going on. Apparently, he had these fluorescent folded-in bulbs that were flashing rather quickly in a way that they seemed to interact with the scan rate of the LCD on his laptop. And if you looked at the laptop with just the right illumination, with the background of the of his fixture that was flickering from the fluorescent light, you could blow out your eyeballs. It was painful. I had him change it to an incandescent bulb, and it all went away. But I haven't really seen that much in the literature. I think it just was happenstance. It was just a perfect storm of scan rates interacting.
All right, I guess you'll be back to me. WHCDL, very good. Well, I guess you saw that firsthand. And, yeah, that was what is basically I was alluding to, is that, you know, the scan rate, the refresh rate, and how our eyes react to it and causes these symptoms. Because I know that I get it. You know, not severe, but I do notice. And I can't stay in front of a computer CRT for a very long time. What I mean, you know, like maybe half an hour, 45 minutes, maybe an hour at the most, before I start feeling some effects in that aspect. So, okay. So I limit myself. And, and this has nothing to do with x-rays or anything else, because there's no high voltage. Well, actually, there is a little bit of high voltage for the, for the backlight illuminator, but not like x-rays has it, and high voltage of a CRT. So that I can understand. Okay, all right, pass it around, Roy. Thank you very much. I'm going to go into the storm here and sitting in the car. AC2GS, WA2CDL. Talk to you soon.
Very good, Andy. Go to your buy your stuff in the store. And high voltages isn't really a problem with modern LCD because basically they're light emitting diodes behind a liquid crystal display that's triggered off and on by transistors embedded in the liquid crystal displays. So whatever voltage potential you need to light up LEDs is the only thing. So I don't think anyone in their wildest imagination is going to suggest that they're going to get X-ray admissions from an LED-based liquid crystal display. But you go and buy your stuff there. Next on my list of people who wanted to say something was Craig. One more time, Craig, are you out there? You were mentioning something, I think, about proper illumination when watching a computer display.
All right, I was wrapping up cables, was cleaning stuff up. Anyway, my question was if Andy was looking at the computer monitor with lights, which is what I'm doing right now, or in a completely dark room. Plus, I'm wearing my eyeglasses, so I can see a lot better and not really get a headache. But I tend to work on my computer with adequate lighting. I tend to not use it if it's dark because I feel like that's bad.
I would tend to agree with you, Craig. It does produce some eye strain to go from dark to bright light. If you're in a room that's basically dark except for the flashlight of LCD displays, it's very, can be very disconcerting and very tiring. Your iris is opening and closing and opening and closing, and it's just a mess. And for about 10 minutes, they were selling these strange little devices for televisions. I don't know if you ever saw them, because they didn't last too long, although I still see them occasionally being advertised. They're basically backlights for a television set, so they light up the wall behind them. It's not as bright as if you had a fixture with a complete light in the room, but it lightens up the background, so it's not that severely dark and then the bright light. But it's not a good idea to run your computer screens with a dark room, you know, unless you're in a goth mood, I guess.
Yeah, my four monitors plus my laptop, so yeah, I can see everything just fine. I've never, ever felt tired when watching, like, a gigantic TV screen at a movie theater, even though it's dark in there, but that seems a little bit different. What are your thoughts on that?
In that case, it's a matter of size. Some people will tell you that you should select your resolution and your screen size for the distance you plan to be from the display. So in a movie screen, the image is so wide that it kind of wraps around. And unless you turn your head extremely to the right or the left, you're not going to be seeing the darkness. You're going to be seeing the screen most of the time. So as long as you have an enormous screen that you're looking at, you tend not to have to worry too much about the ambient light in the room. Computer screens, even the biggest ones, are not big enough to really take over your entire visual view. So there's going to be bits and pieces in your vision that are going to be jet black, and others that are going to be burning hot white. So that's why movie theaters don't give you that problem, where computer screens very likely would.
Okay, so basically it just acts like a light source. Okay. The last thing also that I sometimes notice, and this actually does happen a lot while I'm driving, if you actually want to hear it.
Sure, Craig. Let it rip.
For some reason, I see way better at nighttime driving without my eyeglasses when it's supposed to be a lot worse. I do not know how my eyes are able to process that well.
Okay, that's a curiosity, because generally speaking, pinholes, if the light was very, very high in intensity, what most people's irises do is they constrict down to a pinhole size, and that kind of lessens the inability of the lenses in your eye to poorly focus. So in general, most people's vision is a little bit better in bright light than in dark light, so it's sort of interesting how it works for you. Maybe there's some kind of local astigmatism in the center of your pupil that's less severe when you're more fully dilated?
82 OCB. The problem also is I've had my eyeglasses adjusted twice, and it's still the same. I see better at night without them when I'm not supposed to.
Hey, once again, that's a mystery. I would have assumed that if there was any kind of visual problem, some people have little pinpoint cataracts in the center, that might kind of impact on when in bright light situations. So the fact that your optometrist or ophthalmologist didn't share anything like that with you, I guess he's mystified as well.
Okay. Although I continue to wear my eyeglasses while driving at night, because I'm actually required to, according to the restriction on my license. But enough on that. I'm going to have to look more into this the next time I get my my eyes looked at, because something seems up with them if this is happening, I guess. All right, that's all. Thanks. KD2OGB.
welcome, Craig. And, you know, if you have an opportunity to ask a ophthalmologist this question while he's poking his eyeball and looking at yours, that would be interesting to learn about.
I've asked quite a few people, and they don't exactly know what it could be.
It certainly is a mystery. Well, the trouble is, I don't know exactly what's going on with your eyeball geometry, whether you have astigmatism, whether you have any kind of opacities or any kind of scarring in your cornea or such. There's a lot of variable nature to eyeballs.
It makes sense. Usually I have my eyeglasses for distance and for reading, and usually it adjusts between the two.
I mean, you're going at a different focal length, so you need different focusing lens for different distances, because your eyeball isn't capable of adjusting its lens from the normal narrow distance to infinity.
Another problem I have driving at night is if I do wear my eyeglasses, then the traffic lights are all distorted unless I'm super close to them, and they're non-reflective lenses.
Yeah, unfortunately, optical devices can introduce their own interesting problems. Unfortunately, as you mentioned, you can't really have a discussion like this with a police officer. If he stops you and sees on your license that you're supposed to be wearing glasses, he's not going to really discuss ophthalmology with you. He's just going to give you a ticket. So I guess, unfortunately, you're stuck using the glasses, even if they don't give you the best of image quality at night. And like I said, the next time you're sitting in your ophthalmologist's examining chair, ask him and see if he comes up with a good reason. Because he'll be looking straight down into your retina. He'll know more than anyone else what's going on inside there.
I hope that this is not painful in any way, because I do not feel like having that.
Most ophthalmological exams are not invasive. The most invasive, and I'm sure you've had tests with glaucoma, where they blow a little air and they see what kind of tension your eyeball is under. That's about the most that ophthalmologists, you know, they're not dentists. They don't inflict any pain that I'm aware of.
That I have had done, and I have been told I don't see any big changes so far in my eyes. So I don't know what else I could probably do right now.
I don't know. You're still rather young. There's a lot of time for your eyeballs to change over the years. It happens to the best of us.
Truthfully, it actually will get worse over time, and it happens to almost everybody. There's nothing you can do about it.
Yeah, things kind of break, things fall apart. The elasticity of your lenses decreases over time. The muscle tone of the muscles that are used to squish it into focus weaken over time. So presbyopia. Farsightedness and nearsightedness tend to kind of slowly happen to people, even to some who weren't wearing glasses when the journey began. So it's part of the price you pay for growing older, especially if you use your eyes a lot. Although a lot of ophthalmologists don't think that using your eyes causes any of this, it's other factors.
Okay, I'll take your consideration. And plus, I'm due for a checkup soon anyway, so maybe I'll look more into this. But I don't really have anything else left to say, so thanks. KD2, OGB.
Welcome, Craig. Richie, N2EO, you wanted to say something.
Yes, I do, Roy. I know the subject has changed. I would have been here a few minutes earlier. I was laying in bed, but you brought up ADHD and things like that. I have Tourette's syndrome, and it seems now the finding that ADHD, depression, actually more bipolar disorder, goes hand in hand with Tourette's. Not everybody has both, but most. And I have ADHD. I take medicine, an antidepressant called, what is it called now? I forget the name, but I take that, and I take something for the mania part. I do all right. What generally gets me upset, and really going, is when somebody is nasty to me. And I had a couple of bouts of that, three of them, with the home care agency. So I won't go into those problems, but the two definitely go together. And I guess that's all I got to say. And to you, back to you, boy.
Hey, Richie, I believe that you're taking Klonopin for this. And you kind of mix things together. There is some tendency between mental health issues, depression and such, and attention deficit disorder. They're not the same thing, though. Bipolar disorders, there's manic depressiveness, and attention deficit disorder, hyperactivity is somewhat different. But there is some mutual tendencies to have both. Then what you were discussing is tends to be more of anger management type of thing, where emotional lability and where something kind of sets people off to a degree that's inappropriate for the situation. Usually, I don't know if medicine helps as much as behavioral modification training that a good psychologist can do.
Okay, boy. Well, the ADHD, I know when I was in junior high school, I remember very vividly saying to my mom that it takes me a longer time than the other kids to learn something. It takes me longer, but when I learn it, I know it. I remember telling her that, so I guess that's part of the ADHD, and I do calm down. But my way of calming down is to lay down in bed, have the lights turned off, and just a night light. I have the cat lights to go in bed with me. So I'll get into bed, stroke the cat, and I relax, go to sleep for an hour or so, and I'm fine.
Hey, Richie, ultimately, it's whatever works for you, works for you.
Okay, well, one of the A's was just talking to me here, so I missed that comment.
Okay. It's just telling you that if it works for you, go with it, because if something works, you use it. If it doesn't work, you find some better method. But if it works for you, then go with it.
Absolutely, boy. And the cat is a big help. That's why I've adopted him from the ASPCA. He's very friendly and nice to have around. And it's nice to have somebody or a thing that loves you. And I love him. So I do a lot of good things for myself, because I'm helping him. Like the air purifier I bought when I got him. It's clean in here now. No cigarette smoke. Very little. Somebody who comes here who has asthma could never say it here. Now she can. She said it's much, much better. So anyway, that's about it. But that, like you say, what works, you do it. As far as the computer,
yeah.
As far as the computer, boy, I have cataracts, which is not from anything. I've had it for a while. Everything is fuzzy. I have to get up very close to the screen on small letters. But I manage from a distance. look double horizontally because, I don't know, maybe your eyes are different, whatever. Anyway, back you were taking up enough time. And to Leo.
Hey, Richie, I wish you well. That's most likely an effect of the cataract. If you have an obstruction in the middle of your field of view, sometimes you'll get this kind of double image distortion in the eye. So that's probably an aspect of your cataracts. But I wish you well, Rich. Anyone with any further comments or questions, or I'll move on to the next story. Okay, how do you see something that's invisible? As reported by Space.com, a team of scientists have come up with a new way to spot dim black holes by looking at how they influence light given off by stars around them. A black hole swallow light, which makes them impossible to observe directly. The easiest black holes to spot are those which form a binary system with a star, such as Cygnus X1's black hole, which is paired with a blue supergiant. As the black hole and the star orbit around each other, the black hole pulls matter away from the star and devours it, giving off X-rays in the process. Scientists can spot these X-rays and deduce the existence of a black hole that way. This technique only locates black holes which are near enough their partner star to draw away material. However, there are thought to be many, many black holes that don't get close enough to swallow material and produce X-rays, making them dimmer and even harder to locate. The new study demonstrates how to spot these dimmer black holes using the example of a binary system consisting of a giant star with the very iconic name of 2-mass J0521565A plus 4359220 and an unknown partner. The team was able to determine that the partner was in fact a dim black hole by using spectroscopy data. To locate a hidden black hole, the scientists looked at the Doppler shift of the stars and compared this to their brightness over time. A significant Doppler shift can indicate a strong source of gravity, and when a star's brightness goes up and down in a set pattern, that suggests there's a large object orbiting the star, which sometimes blocks its light. Taken together, these two indicators suggest the presence of a black hole. Let me drop for a sec. Having zeroed in on the previously said system as a prime candidate, these scientists were able to determine that the object orbiting around the star must have a mass about three times that of our sun, which indicates that it's likely a small black hole. The next step to proving the usefulness of this approach is for the team to search for more hidden black holes using the same exact method. If they are successful, we could have a new tool for locating numerous black holes throughout our galaxy. By the way, these findings were published in the journal Science. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, here's a funny one. Those rascally Russians have yet another problematic science story. Russian scientists tracking a migrating eagles were forced to start a crowdfunding campaign after their birds wandered into Iran. The foreign text messages from their tracking devices depleted the project's budget. Scientists rang the alarm earlier last month when several endangered steppe eagles were transmitting coordinates via Russian mobile phone numbers, and they wandered into the roaming zone after spending the summer in an area without mobile coverage. These beasts were out of range in Kazakhstan all summer, and now, once they reach the super expensive Iran and Pakistan, they're spewing out hundreds of text messages with their locations, wrote Igor Karyakin of the Russian Raptor Research and Conservation Network. Scientists recently launched a campaign called Top Up the Eagles Mobile to keep the research going with the public's help after taking out a loan to pay for the text messages, costing 49 rubles each. That's about 77 cents, instead of the usual price of 2 to 15 rubles. Quote, they really left us penniless. We had to take out a loan to feed the tracker device. end quote, Kerry Akin wrote recently. Bird lovers, however, have always contributed enough to last through the year. People are still sending money, so there's hope that we can keep the Eagle SIM cards running until they come back from their faraway journeys in early summer to Russia, where mobile connectivity is not so expensive, he wrote. Steppe eagles breed in southern Russia and Kazakhstan and spend their winters in Africa and India. They have experienced a rapid decline due to the spread of farming land across the territory and are vulnerable to wind turbines, according to BirdLife International. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, here's another funny one. Whoever said research might follow odd paths of inquiry? Well, now we have an answer to the apparent age-old question of whether rats can learn to drive a vehicle, and the result is a resounding yes. What's more, the vermin even seem to find the whole endeavor rather relaxing. Researchers at the University of Richmond in Virginia fashioned what may be the world's first ratmobile out of a clear plastic food container. It's mounted on what appears to be a battery-powered four-wheel platform with a piece of aluminum for the floor and three copper bars that function as a steering wheel. Rats were able to move the car forward when they stood on the floor and grip the copper bars with their paws to complete an electrical circuit. The left, center, and right copper bars also control steering, and six females and 11 male rats were rewarded for successfully driving with Fruit Loop cereal placed at increased distances around their pens. Psychology professor Kelly Lambert, a neuroscientist who led the study, told New Scientist that rats had previously been shown to be able to recognize objects, press bars, and find their way around mazes. But she and her colleagues wanted to see whether rats were able to learn the more sophisticated task of operating a moving vehicle. Quote, they learned to navigate the car in unique ways and engaged in steering patterns they had never used to eventually arrive at their reward, Lambert told the publication. Let me drop for a sec. Lest you think this is merely a stunt destined for the late-night TV talk show circuit, there is an important finding here. Learning to drive seems to have a relaxing effect on the vermin, as measured by their levels of corticosteroids, a hormone that spikes in stressful situations, and dehydroepiandrosterone, which counteracts stress. The ratio of the two hormones was flipped in the rats and increased the more they drove. The rats have lived in a complex and stimulating environment, learned how to drive much faster than those who lived in a dreary laboratory, Lambert told Business Insider. Lambert has apparently done previous work that found that rats experience a reduction in stress after they master difficult tasks, like digging up buried food, suggesting that they experience the same kind of satisfaction that people feel after perfecting a new skill. The team also found that rats that drove themselves were less stressed than rats that were driven around as passengers in remote-controlled cars. The practical takeaway from all this is that researchers could substitute driving tests like this one for more traditional maze tests to study things like the effects of Parkinson's disease or on motor skills and spatial awareness. Next up are follow-up experiments to try and understand how rats learn to drive and why it seems to reduce their stress. We can't help but wonder whether that might include introducing the scourge known as traffic to this equation. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WP2GXM.
Yes, GXM.
AC2GS and the group, WP2GXM, Rich. I believe it's time to enact legislation that will prevent rats from joining Uber and Lyft.
No, think of it as the executives in Uber. This might solve a lot of their employment problems.
It's only going to be bad from here on out.
You got to look at it from both sides. I mean, all it takes is a couple of tons of rat food, and you pretty much dealt with your employees. It certainly beats the problems they're having lately with the poor guys that they could barely pay to drive these cars. So I don't know, it might be the future. Personally, I would tend to bet on the robotics, the artificial intelligence running cars. But if someone could figure a way of putting a little mouse into the driver's seat, I'm sure they would go for it.
It's too late.
Flu.
So let me get this straight. If the rats work for Uber and they decide to go on strike, do they walk the line with a big balloon of a human?
Don't know. I guess it's up to their personal choice. I don't know where they would kind of get a big personal human, but I tend to think that if they were on strike, they probably would prefer to go around in those little wheels as opposed to actually walk a line.
Oh, I do that every day.
I know for everyone still working that's what it feels like some days.
Some days, as always.
To be optimistic, yeah. It is going to be a couple of days where you don't want to go on the ground.
And it was very relaxing. So I can see the similarities there.
Unfortunately, there's a lot of similarities between us and mice. I mean, that's why there are guys who make a living every day by just running mice through mazes and timing them and changing the maze and changing the food and writing up articles about it. It's all part of the big circle of life. On to a serious story. In 2014, a rare polio-like illness that attacked the nervous system of its often young victims first emerged in the United States, an illness with no clear cause, according to health agencies like the Center of Disease Control and Prevention. Now scientists at the University of California, San Francisco, say they've unearthed the most conclusive evidence to date that two viruses closely related to polio are to blame. The illness is called acute flaccid myelitis. We've mentioned it before on the Science Talk, or its abbreviation is AFM. As the name indicates, victims experience a sudden weakness of their muscles, which can then become full-on paralysis. This typically affects the arms and legs, but sometimes the facial muscles and the throat as well. In most serious of cases, the paralysis can cause life-threatening respiratory failure. Other times, people are left with lifelong neurological symptoms. Since 2014, around 600 children in the United States are thought to have developed AFM, but cases have been traced back to as far as 2012. These waves of AFM have followed a peculiar pattern, with cases spiking every 2 years like clockwork. In 2018, for instance, there were more than 200 reported cases of AFM, but only 22 cases this year so far. The symptoms of AFM bear an uncanny resemblance to those occasionally caused by poliovirus. But thanks to routine vaccinations, polio has been almost completely wiped out from the globe. Suspicion soon turned to the viruses closely related to polio, a group of germs called enteroviruses that infect us through food, water, and air. Two in particular have been singled out, enterovirus D68, which typically causes the common cold symptoms in children, and A71, which can cause the rashy illness of hand and foot disease. Both D68 and A71 have been found in the spinal fluid and guts of people with AFM, and more than 90% of victims report getting a mild cold before the paralysis began. Research has also found that the strains plucked from human AFM victims can cause an AFM-like illness in mice. But despite an ongoing investigation, the CDC so far has only stated that AFM is probably caused by viruses and that these viruses could include D68 and A71, much to the disappointment of some of the public health experts and scientists. Let me drop for a second. One sticking point for the CDC is that most victims don't show any direct evidence of a virus in their nervous system, let alone an enterovirus. such as viral DNA or RNA. But UCSF scientists say that they found a way to detect the hidden trace of D68 and A71 left behind in AFM patients using a relatively new technology developed by Harvard Medical School researchers and others called the VIRSCAN. VIRSCAN relies on bacteriophages, those are viruses that hunt bacteria, to look for antibodies that our body produces to fend off viruses. But unlike the older test, VIRSCAN is able to identify thousands of viral signatures all at once. In their new study published recently in Nature Medicine, the authors used VIRSCAN on the spinal fluid of 42 children with AFM, as well as control samples taken from 58 children who had other neurological conditions. They found that more than two-thirds of AFM patients had an increased level of antibodies against enteroviruses in their spinal fluid, but not against any other known virus. Conversely, only 7% of control patients had enterovirus antibodies. The results then were confirmed through standard antibody testing. Let me drop for a sec. The strength of this study is not just what was found, but also what was not found, co-author Joe DeRisi, professor of biochemistry and biophysics at UCSF, said in a release from the university. Even before this new research, scientists have pleaded with the CDC to officially blame non-polio enteroviruses as the primary cause of AFM, arguing that the weight of the circumstantial evidence was already enough to render a verdict. In 2014, for instance, the first documented wave of AFM cases were closely preceded by a more serious than usual outbreak of D68, and the authors say theirs is the latest to provide further evidence for a causal role of non-polio enteroviruses in AFM. Assuming the CDC does eventually agree with DeRisi and other experts, though, there are still plenty of mysteries to solve about AFM. It seems likely that something changed along the way in these viruses to start causing AFM, but we don't know exactly what it is. We also don't know why only a few people ever get AFM, given that the enterovirus is common among many sick people. By settling on a culprit now, though, DeRisi and others hope that it'll be easier to begin answering these questions and developing a real solution to AFM, such as a preventive vaccination. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay. Science Talk participant the other week mentioned something about a universal vaccine. Now, I couldn't find anything about it anywhere in the literature. It sounded way too good to be true by his description, but nevertheless, we might be inching closer to a holy grail of medicine, an incredibly effective flu-killing drug that the virus can't quickly adapt to. A new experimental treatment was able to rapidly reduce the flu virus in ferrets, but human trials are still a ways off. Researchers at Georgia State and Emory University have spent the last few years trying to develop what they've billed as the next generation in antivirals. One lead they followed is a molecule that can attack and inhibit a wide variety of RNA viruses. This includes something called chikungunya, Zika, and influenza. Called N4-hydroxycytidine in NHC, in animal experiments at least, NHC seems to throw a big wrench into how RNA viruses replicate itself, leading to rather disastrous fatal mutations on its part. A study with non-human primates, however, suggests that NHC wouldn't easily be absorbed by the human body, limiting its potential effectiveness. So the researchers created different experimental drug candidates based on NHC that seem to get over that hurdle. And it's one of these candidates, called EIDD-2801, that was tested out in ferrets for the new study that was published recently in Science Translational Medicine. As luck would have it, ferrets are remarkably similar to people in how their bodies are attacked by the influenza virus that infects us, making them an ideal animal model for flu research. For the researchers' experiment, the ferrets were first infected with different types of flu, the types that cause us seasonable sniffles, as well as the strain of flu behind a 2009 pandemic. Then they treated with varying oral dosages of that EIDD-2801 0.01, a day into the exposure. Let me drop for a sec. They found that EIDD-2801 was able to dramatically reduce the viral load of these flu strains by multiple orders of magnitude within a day's time, along with alleviating fever and other symptoms of infection, with its performance being comparable to or better than existing antivirals used to treat influenza. And when the EIDD-2801 was given to ferrets immediately before and after flu exposure, it prevented illness from showing up at all. Experiments involving human lung tissue created in petri dishes found similar evidence that EIDD-2801's lethality. The compound is highly efficacious against influenza, a senior study author said in a release from the university. It's orally available, it's broad spectrum against all influenza virus strains tested, and most important, it establishes a high barrier against viral escape from inhibition. RNA viruses are more genetically unstable than viruses that replicate using DNA, but this instability comes with a benefit because they can quickly mutate into versions that resist drugs and vaccines we would want to use on them. That's why we need a new vaccine every year for seasonal flu, and it's also why some current antivirals developed against flu are already practically useless. But when the researchers sequenced the genome of influenza viruses exposed to sublethal dosages of EIDD-2801, they found no evidence of any beneficial mutations that might grant them resistance. That finding doesn't mean that the viruses couldn't become resistant to EIDD-2801 someday, but it does suggest it won't be quite as easy. Still, it's as useful as ferrets are for studying flu. The real test will be when it comes to clinical trials involving humans. And such trials may get underway by next year. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, I guess one more story before we call it quits tonight. Researchers used an MRI scanner to observe changes in parts of the brain associated with learning and learned experiences while volunteers completed tasks that involved a reward. Participants also attended two sessions prior to scanning to compare their individual association between stimulus sequences and rewards. They found that the changes seen in participants' neural pathways associated with learning were different depending upon how each person had learned that new task. The researchers said, "We know that humans can learn in different ways. Sometimes we learn simply by observing relationships in the world, such as learning the layout of a new town or relationships between people. But another way to learn is by setting particular goals, like children learning to operate toys by trial and error. This research shows that we have multiple networks in the brain that help us store learned knowledge or associations, which means that damage to one part of the brain will still leave alternative mechanisms available for learning. Quote, we also learned that some of this knowledge is very persistent, and the brain does not forget about it even when it becomes irrelevant, while knowledge acquired through an alternative learning mechanism is more flexible and can be more easily changed to new knowledge. As well as showing that the brain can learn in different ways and that these multiple mechanisms for learning rely on the concerted effort of multiple different brain networks. The study also shows that unlearning associations can be easier when they are acquired by observations compared to a goal-directed manner. Quote, it's well known that it is good for our brains to continue to learn new things throughout our life, which is why understanding the different ways in which we learn and store information could be beneficial and help each of us find out which way of learning suits us the best. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
Roy, this might be related to the great difficulty of establishing artificial intelligence. To try to teach a human, to try to teach a machine to act at all like a human brain has been a serious challenge for a long time. And so the even though that computer program that that could play certain games, I can't think of the name of the darn thing now, although it can gather lots of information from lots of areas, it behaves very differently than a human brain. How a human brain really works, I think, is a bit of a mystery. You could ask the question, will a human mind ever really understand a human mind? Maybe you got some comments on all of the above. Over to you, Roy, K2LIW. I'm back on the Western input.
Dick, I think you were alluding to IBM's Deep Blue, which is a fascinating device. Basically, we know very little about the nitty-gritty details of the brain. We do know the vague general architecture, which is different than most computers that we use. Most actual electronic computers are serial devices, if you will. They might have more than one core. Sometimes they have 18. Sometimes they have in the 20s. But it's still a limited number of cores, and the data goes in and the data goes out in a rather serial manner. Neural networks of our brain are much more parallel processing computational devices. And for whatever reason, it appears that regular computer architecture is very good at symbol manipulation. They do math much faster than we can. But neural networks in our brain are much better with pattern recognition. So there's a dramatic difference in the inherent architecture. You can mimic neural networks in computers. It takes a lot of overhead, a lot of processing time. You have to teach it by repeating the exercise over and over again before it builds up a kind of an internal matrix of behaviors. You have these deep fake images of people saying things that they never said that are driven by a neural network software design. But I hope that we someday are able to kind of look into ourselves and figure ourselves out. There's a lot of philosophers who question that it's an inherent limitation. An object can't understand itself. But we've proved a whole bunch of those kind of philosophical concepts wrong before. I hope we do again. There's still a great deal of work to do on the brain. We sort of know roughly areas where sort of thoughts go and come and interact. But we need to know a lot more, and we have to figure out if there's a way of actually interfacing with external devices so that we can kind of interact with the stimuli directly and have a true kind of input-output circuit between electronic devices and the neural networks of our brain. So it's going to be fascinating. I don't think there's... there might be hope at the end of the tunnel. I don't think it's a fait accompli that we're just too complex to be able to figure ourselves out. But, you know, science will either figure it out or not. Technology...
Repeater. Timeout. Repeater. Timeout. Cancel.
Well, pattern recognition is really required. It's for automatic driving machines. And to be able to recognize a pedestrian, a person on a bicycle, a person jaywalking, another vehicle, a tractor-trailer truck, side view, and so on. There are people who believe automatic driving machines will eventually be safer than human beings. But boy, there's been a number of classic errors detected in the last couple of years on the attempts to make automatic driving machines, which does show a great degree of difficulty here.
That would be people.
Oh, yeah. So being able to recognize a pedestrian for an automatic driving machine apparently represents a significant difficulty. You may have some comments on all of the above, Roy. AC2GS, K2IW.
I agree with you, Dick. It's a great deal of it's a great problem that is being addressed and continues to be addressed and fine tuned, and they have to build in redundancies because you can't acceptably allow something like a 98% success, because the 2% will get you in court for the rest of your life and bankrupt your business. So they're going to have to make it. Nothing's going to ever be 100%. I can perceive a time where insurance companies will penalize people for driving their own cars when the technology advances to the point of accidents due to artificial intelligence are significantly less than human beings. Some like 30,000 to 35,000 people die in the United States every year car-related injuries. So if theoretically you could switch over everyone to a computer and have that drop 50%, that's a 50% improvement. I think human nature being human nature, I don't think they would accept 15,000 people dying from automated driving machines. So they're probably going to have to get that number down. Whether mankind is foolish enough to say that they won't approve it until it reaches 100% results, I don't know. People can be rather silly at times.
CHYS, comment.
Your comment.
This is AC2IS. My understanding was that self-driving vehicles were already better at humans if you're just going to judge by the number of fatalities per mile. AC2IS.
Yes, but that's not enough, unfortunately. Just talk to the average human being. Apparently, they would much rather have human beings kill 30,000 people a year than, just kind of pick any number in the thousands and ask them if everyone switched over to an automated system and only 2,000 people died every year of an automated car trip. I'm willing to bet you'd have a lot of emotional resistance to that.
GXM.
Stretch.
There was a PBS program on recently that addressed this issue. And one significant finding came from the fact that machines do very well when they follow the rules. But looking at the human beings around them, human beings are breaking the rules all the time, and the machines cannot deal with that. Thank you.
T2IS, comment?
Net tonight at 8 o'clock. This is the W2VL repeater. Net time complete.
CIS, what's your comment?
Again, my understanding is that the biggest problem that I'm aware of that self-driving vehicles face is difficulty in distinguishing between bridges and tractor trailers. It seems like even the different major versions of software, this mistake has been made, I think, more than three times. A self-driving vehicle can see under something. It thinks that it can go under that thing. And when you have tractor trailers with a high clearance underneath, it seems like there have been multiple instances already of, I think, just Teslas trying to go under vehicles like that where they don't have clearance to do so. Otherwise, I think most of the other stuff we're talking about, it deals with pretty well. Is anyone aware of any other instance of a quote-unquote failure of a Tesla self-driving vehicle? AC2IS.
WS2IS.
Yes, Paul.
A PBS show that he had mentioned did have topics dealing with the Tesla vehicle. And there's different different levels. You know, they have level 1, 2, and 3. You know, where one level is, you know, you need to have automated machine with the passenger, you know, at the wheel. Another one is, you know, where they could have a car and a passenger, you know, doesn't touch the wheel at all, ever. You know, and then another one eventually would be a car that would go by itself. They've calculated all of this, and to make a long story short, they had, I think, a couple of million hours of human driving without a fatal accident, and they can't get the machines anywhere near that yet. And they have self-driving cars in Arizona. They were testing them, and now they took them off the road because of these couple of accidents. And, you know, because it's dry, flat, no problem. But, you know, you put those cars in the mountains with snow and rain and all kinds of problems in the city. You know, to me, it looked like they're 20 years away from doing it, at least.
Well, that's the magic number that everyone pulls out of some orifice when it comes to things like fusion. As a mode of energy, you know, it's the magic 20 years in the future. I tend to be more sanguine. I think that there are certainly some bumps in the road, but I would be sort of amazed if it takes any longer than 10 years, unless there's some kind of real technological snafu or some terrible calamity strikes that's going to turn everyone against the concept. Things seem to be going along reasonably well, so I tend to be a wee bit more optimistic than you as far as this prediction is concerned.
Autonomous, what they claim to be truly autonomous self-driving vehicles has not been getting a lot of press, but UPS says they're there already.
I did a story on that a couple of months ago, and Rich, K2 UPS, who's a UPS driver, talked about the subject as well. So I think the future is practically here. It's right now, for the most part, it's semi-experimental around the edges, but it's, I sort of remember how technology kind of sneaks up on people. I used to get publications about computer hardware and software, and it became a kind of a badge that every year was announced to be the year of the network, and it didn't happen, and next year was the year of the network, and it didn't happen. And people started to do the 20-year thing about it. And then all of a sudden, one day, it just, Ethernet took off, and the rest is just history. No one makes jokes about the year of the network. So it'll be a story until the day it's a reality, and then it'll just be ubiquitous all over the places, and there'll be a lot of people upset that their insurance premiums will go sky high if they take the steering wheel themselves. Right. I want to thank everyone for participating tonight. I enjoyed myself. I hope people listening and people participating enjoyed themselves as well. I just want to remind everyone that if you have any mailbag questions for Dick and you can't get on to the net proper, or if you have any comments for Paul about the space report, or if you would like to suggest a topic to me, or a story that you read, or a video that you saw, or you have a puzzler that you'd like to share, then the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And I'm going to post all this plus Paul's picture that I'll be talking about soon on my webpage, which is roy.ac2gs. And once again, thanks Paul, and thanks to Dick for the opportunity to do this here. And I will turn it over to Dick so that he can turn it over to Paul for the space report.
Thank you, Roy. Lots of wide-ranging subjects there. Paul, what's going on in space? WS2N, K2LIW.
Okay, this is WS2N, and there's a couple of space topics that I'd like to talk about, that's for sure. But Roy had a lot of good topics tonight as well. I usually start off with the launches, the upcoming launches. There's one launch, but it's not going into space. It's a test that's coming up on tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock Eastern, where you'd be able to watch it on NASA TV. It's a very short flight. It's only going to be a couple of minutes when it goes up, but it's a ground test for Starliner. Starliner is a spacecraft being built by Boeing. We have two companies that are building spacecraft to be able to carry four people each to the International Space Station. One is SpaceX, you know, with their Dragon crew vehicle, and the other one is Boeing with the Starliner. It's called the CST-100, 100 because 100 kilometers above the Earth. They were going to be happy when the thing got that far. Well, they call it the Starliner, and that's going to be able to carry four people. They expect to probably launch people to the space station by early next year.